Welcome. You're about to be ushered past the velvet rope and into a world of hyper-effective salesmanship that's understood and used only by the world's most notoriously rich and successful marketers. We're taking a journey deep inside the human brain, past the surface clutter, and into the psychological insights to answer the one crucial question: what makes people buy? I'm your host, Kevin Rogers, along with the most ripped off and respected copywriter alive, John Carlton. And this is Psych Insights for Modern Marketers. Hi, it's Kevin Rogers. Welcome to Psych Insights with myself and John Carlton. Let's get right into it. This is what John calls Psych Insight number 48. Everyone has dreams of glory growing up. The vast majority quash them early and maintain a steady diet of intellectual white noise to cover the faint screams of frustration from their locked away desires. A small percentage sort of pursue their dreams, but never, ever allow the curtain to come up on their show. They plan, they flirt with starting something, then retreat at the first sign of resistance from the universe. The tiny slice of entrepreneurs who actually get moving have levels too, from skittish, low-info, shallow pond treaders who probably got into this business back accidentally, through the struggling folks bulging in the middle of the curve, to the few who force success to happen by never admitting defeat. Your lists are rife with all of these categories. Most profit will come from a minority. Understand who's populating your list, and lots of marketing problems suddenly make sense. John, this is a topic that we've covered quite a bit on this show, but it, yes, it can't be explored deeply enough, because again, there I believe is a large chasm to how entrepreneurs, like you said in the example here, the ones who make it have sort of been through this. They've broken out of the stratosphere and into a different way of thinking. They had the seeds of those thinkings from the beginning. It's very hard to remember and to stay in contact with where most of the people who populate our lists and where they live every day. I had a unique opportunity to this week interview 9 people in one day who had all gone out of their way to qualify for a very unique opportunity to meet with a famous, let's call it a life coach, for lack of a better term. Yeah. And they had, you know, like I said, put in some effort to get on the phone with me just to answer some questions. And one of the questions I was asking them is, when was the happiest time in your life?
Should be an easy question, right?
Yeah. And every one of them stumbled on it. And what really struck me was a couple of them just couldn't answer. Mm-hmm. because they couldn't choose one, because they didn't have one. And what I expected the answer would have been is if they say, you know, I like to think it hasn't happened yet. That's that's an acceptable answer.
Yeah, but yes, it is.
But that never came either. Yeah. And so I was really struck. And that's why when I was looking through the Psych Insights, this one jumped out at me. Mm-hmm. And you and I have had a pretty hearty dialogue just planning this show. So I'm really interested to get your big idea thought behind, you know, writing it and then digging into very shallow depths of it.
This is like the basic, now I have a degree in psychology. I like to tell people I have a degree in psychology. It's a bachelor's degree, but it was from the University of California. But, and almost everything I learned back then has been, proven wrong, or psychology has taken a sharp turn from there. This was all pre-NLP, and I actually had Freudians still teaching and things like that, but they were doing a lot of science stuff. But I maintained my interest in psychology, and even though I didn't become a psychologist, I have paid attention to what we call pop psychology, which dovetails very nicely with salesman street psychology. So I've been very interested in breaking down how humans think and what goes on inside of humans' minds. A lot of this gets back to me being a kid growing up without that special uncle who would take me aside and tell me things. John, this is how the world really is. You know, people will lie to your face. I wish I just had somebody come up to me and say, John, everybody else is also leading lives of quiet desperation. Maybe handed me, you know, the book by Thoreau. What is that? I'm sure where that's from. Mm-hmm. But it was I grew up with the idea that I was the only one suffering from not knowing what to do and not understanding what was going on. I kept thinking if I could just understand what people were thinking, then the answers to all these problems I had in life would suddenly become, you know, manifest. And what I learned eventually was that people weren't thinking at all. Mm. A lot of them just went through life without a thought in their head. And a lot of times that was as balm or defense against leading lives of quiet desperation. They didn't like where their life had gone. They didn't like where it was going. They didn't even want to think about it. They had trouble, you know, putting one foot in front of the other through the day. Mm. And as I got into marketing, it became imperative that I really understand who I was writing to, who the audience for this particular message was, and what their needs were. You know, the one way of thinking about this is to join the conversation already in their head. That's a very popular saying among copywriters and marketers. Join the conversation already going on in your prospect's mind, which is he wakes up in the middle of the night. Oh my God, I'm worried about sending my kids to college and the roof of the house needs fixing and I don't know if my 401k is even filled up, blah, blah, blah. Answer those questions to do that. But that's a shallow way of looking at it. A much deeper way is to get into the psychology of what is it like to be human in the 21st century of especially the Western world. If you're marketing in America and Europe and what we call the first world, what is it like? And the more you get into this, the more you understand that despite the fact that we think happiness should be pandemic, it is in fact maybe, as certain philosophers are looking at it, may be that most humans are just built to be relatively unhappy, and the happiness part is the thing you have to fight for. We're not sure how this works out, but if you write a book on how to be happy, you're going to get a lot of attention, especially if you're a shrink or you know, you want to get on Oprah or something like that. So when I'm going to a list of people, and this is kind of like Psych 1A. If I could just bunch everything that I learned academically in psychology and everything that I learned from the street salesmen who were so good at understanding people and understanding where they were at and how to persuade and how to break through resistance and objections, that little Psych 1A thing is this particular psych. It's that idea that people aren't getting the recognition they feel is their birthright. They feel – I mean, a human – who is leading even a minimally fulfilled life is getting recognition, is if not free from fear, at least in a point of maintaining themselves in a position of not being afraid all the time. And if even if they're not wealthy, they're not worried about tomorrow or tonight or you know, right, putting food on the table. Yeah. So these fears, whether they are real or not, these are the things that do wake people up and drive a lot of people into marketing situations. Regardless of what your product is, you are usually, in the vast majority of the cases, when you're marketing something, you are fixing a problem in your prospect's life. Yeah. And that's the first thing that a lot of copywriters lose sight of is just – what you're selling is not boring. It may be boring to you, but it's not boring to the guy who has a problem that this is going to fix.
Right.
Whether you're selling nails so the guy can go finish the birdhouse out back and make his little daughter happy so the hummingbirds come back, or, you know, because his life is stuck until he gets that damn birdhouse fixed, or whether it's a guy who just discovered, you know, got bad news from the doctor and he needs information. He needs to know everything that is possible to know about what he needs to do next and how he should deal with this from his end, you know, regardless of what the medical side does. So, you know, there's these levels of things, but most people operate at this level of high anxiety, this sense of when one of the big discoveries I made early on was the idea of the party that you weren't invited to. And I kept thinking about that. It was like, for a lot of guys in the 60s, that was defined as the Playboy Mansion. Mm. You know, Hugh Hefner was having a party and you weren't invited, but you could get glimpses into it. You could see how they live. Mm. So people are looking for ways of ideas, models of how they might live or what they might aspire to or what may make them happy. And most people are outside looking in. They're, you know, they rub off a spot in the window. They're out in the cold and the snow. They're looking in. There's a feast going on inside.
Right.
So that a lot of marketing, even if it's for minor stuff, but especially if it's for stuff like life coaches or for marketing seminars where you're going to teach people how to market better to make their business thrive where the business is struggling now, things like that. You're talking about a transformation that is incoherent in their head because they can't clearly understand unless they've been successful and then went bankrupt. But that's a small minority of people. If they're still clawing their way into success, they don't have a clear idea of what's happening. They are, in fact, leading lives of quiet desperation. It's like you ask the large number, you take a broad swath of the population of America right now, and it'll include a whole bunch of people that aren't doing very well and a few people who are maybe have money but aren't happy. And you ask them, what is happiness to you, as you had an opportunity to do? And many of them will struggle because they don't have an idea. They may think, oh, if I won the lottery, I'd be happy. Really? Let's look at the history of people who win the lottery. Do they get happy? No. We know that the average lottery winner is right back where they were within a couple of years, broke and desperate again, because right. because money doesn't fix problems of unhappiness.
Just with more enemies now.
Or more bills. Yeah. That, you know, so they had a taste of it.
Something strikes me as you're talking about all this. I'll never forget after I started my business, I was incredibly successful in my eyes. I wasn't making a ton of money yet, but I was working on my terms, my own hours. And one day I was, you know, consumed with a client's issue or something, and I'm driving down the road. It's it was beer 30 on a Friday, right? And there was a truck load of landscapers next to me on the road, and in the back was about, you know, however many guys you can not legally fit in the back of a pickup truck, and they were sipping their beers and ducking them down, and these guys couldn't have been happier. I mean,
yep.
I just looked at them and I thought, you know, there's the value of just living it, man. There's no way they got anything covered. They don't have health insurance. They don't have, you knew by looking, and they couldn't have been happy. They literally got to experience beer 30, right? And I just thought, well, you know, maybe you just need to quit aiming so high. And what are we really chasing after here? But here's the thing. There's no way to get that genie back in the bottle once you realize there is a better way. There is a certain amount of freedom to be had. There's this like huge ramp up until maybe you can actually achieve something that looks like what you thought it would be in your head. But, you know, a lot along the way, there's these moments where you go, is all of this worth it, or should I just throw this all out and go get on that truck with those guys?
I think you hit on to a couple of things there. One is that people can probably say, if you ask them what they wanted, they may say some version of, I want money and I want to be happy. However they say it, you know, I want to get married. I'm really lonely. I need to pay off these bills. I do this. It all comes down to they want to be rich and happy. But they can't define rich and happy. They don't understand it. And often, as you talk about these guys in the truck, they may have just spent – one of them may have spent his entire paycheck buying a couple of – you know, a chest of beer to share with his guys. And tomorrow he's not going to be happy. But right now he's happy. And it's kind of funny that there's a Zen quality to living that kind of life where you're not worried about what happens later. You're – very concerned with the here and now. It could be destructive, that kind of, I hesitate to call it Zen, but it is an in-the-moment experience because it is kind of selfish if you're ignoring responsibilities.
Right.
The true Zen life would be take care of your responsibilities, do this in the here and now, and enjoy the moment, but also take, you know, clean up your messes, don't destroy other people's lives.
Right.
But, you know, Halbert and I used to joke all the time when we would be going down at zero beer 30 down the freeway and everybody else is off to a bar to go drink. And we got to go and write some more because we got a, you know, an event tomorrow. We got a client flying in. And it's like we're thinking, what are we doing? Why don't we just quit and go get jobs at, you know, do the night shift at the 7-Eleven, you know, and just when you're done, you lock the door, you're done with the job. Right. And then you go into the next part of life. As a writer, as a business owner, you never leave the job. You know, it's there all the time. And that's why they talk about businessmen waking up in the middle of the night. So that's part of it. But I think the main thing is helping as a writer, if you can narrow it down into we've talked about fear and greed before as the basic lizard brain responses that kind of start everything, and then you work into the Maslow hierarchy of, mm-hmm. of need. But if you can start to identify the basic other parts of this, are you writing to an audience who is generally unhappy or feeling unmoored or anchorless or bobbing around on the surface of life? Can you narrow it down? Do they think that what you offer is going to fix all of the problems in their lives or one part? And you're lucky if it's one part. Like, rather than try to address their ideas of being rich and happy, what if you're just trying to address the happiness part? You know, so you don't have to worry about them making money. This is not that problem that you're dealing with. Mm-hmm. It's just the happiness part, which might be the example I use of just finding the right nail to finish the birdhouse out back so your young daughter is happy because the hummingbirds have returned. You know, if you nail into that, you can get into that, because an average writer will say, how do I sell nails? It's like, I got nails. You want nails? You know, come on and buy them. Mm-hmm. But a more advanced writer may explore the idea that if you have the right audience and if you understand that audience, you're certainly not going to get a list of 100,000 guys who are building birdhouses in the backyard. But if you have a little bit of that insight, you start to look into it, and even you start the dialogue, then you've moved into advanced salesman areas where those guys who were street savvy salesmen knew or could find very quickly what was making this guy tick or what was making this guy not tick when he wanted to tick more and more likely. How do I fix it? You know, if it's like finding the oil can for the Tin Man, you know, finding the brain for the Scarecrow, things like that. When you can narrow it down, so you have this broad idea of the sense of lost, lonely, desperate human race, and you start to narrow it down. Well, I'm actually going after this, so my product matches this audience up in this way. And when you start doing that, then you move into advanced marketing territory, and all kinds of problems disappear. It's like the basic question: how do I sell nails? How do I sell my accounting business to somebody? How do I sell my seminar to somebody, you know, when people don't want to go to seminars? And it keeps coming back to, well, you don't sell seminars, you don't sell nails, and you don't sell the idea of talking to a coach twice a week. You sell what the benefits are of that. Right. And you can't really get down to the benefits until you understand what the problems are that people are going to. Kevin, you and I have talked. I love pop psychology, mm-hmm. and I love street level psychology. A lot of it's very simple, but it's profound in its simplicity. Until you know these simple psychological little samplings of the human race, you're like everybody else, and you're kind of totally freaking clueless about it. A lot of people think they're unhappy, and here's the key: they're unhappy and everyone else is happy. Because if you only had what your neighbors had, you know, they just bought a new car. They don't seem to be having financial problems.
Right.
You know, I'm not going to name names or anything, but you know, I live in an area of town, so you know, it's a cul-de-sac, and you get down just below the surface of these people, it's a good part of town. These are nice. These are custom houses. This is, you know, we live in a beautiful area. I can walk 15 feet in any direction and find a great path to walk through with pines and stuff. And you think there'd be happiness. I happen to know a lot of the people in the neighborhoods around here, and they're desperately unhappy. They're you know, the number of people who are underwater, in bad marriages, having troubles with their kids, all kinds of things going on. You know, the ticker's going bad, you know, or just every single problem you can have, it's there. And so the patina of happiness that people present to the rest of the world, the happy face we present to the rest of the world, is okay for most people to be able to look at and say, okay, you know, I live in a world and people are okay, and that's how you want to live. As a marketer, you can't do that. You got to look deeper. You got to at least get through Psych 1A, which is understanding how why your prospect is in this market. In the first place. And your experience is just I think the lessons that you learn from calling or having those people call you or calling them is gonna continue to expand in your mind. That's, you know, the fact that you recognize that as a lesson is step one. And then the idea that there are further lessons from that, that the radiation from this it can affect everything else you do in marketing and in life, understanding these things. Was there anything else that came out of that experience?
No, but I'll tell you, that's something that I've taken to doing more and more. And it's a great asset to be able to work with clients who do have a customer base that they're close to and can reach out and either get people to raise their hands and go, I'd love the opportunity to get closer to you, or they already have relationships and they put me in contact with them. There is nothing like getting on the phone with the prospect. Nothing like it. You can let your expert tell you a million different ways why their stuff is the greatest, but you hear it from the person who's felt the effects, you got nothing. So what are the questions, John, for any marketer who realizes maybe they're thinking here, the market's thinking here, is how do you bridge that gap? Do you blatantly come out and say you could be happier if, or is it a more subtle approach to leading people?
That's a great question.
Do you let them come to that conclusion on their own? Is there more power in that throwing it at them?
Yeah, it's always better to make them come to the conclusion on their own. And you can't preach. People are fairly numb about being happy. They've been I was one of those shy, introverted guys who didn't realize it, but I was presenting a rather dour face to the world in much of my life. And I've had people come up to me many times and say, dude, smile. Yeah. I remember once I was in Key West and I was sitting there in a sunny day with a beer in an outdoor cafe. And I was just sitting there and I was thinking about stuff. I was there for a meeting with Halbert and I was alone for a while. And this guy walks up to me, this drunk, and he walks up and he stops. He looks at me and says, dude, lighten up. You're in Key West. And he slaps me on the back and says, you look depressed. And then he walks off. And I'm thinking, oh, geez, you know, thanks. Kind of woke me up. And I think about that guy all the time. This guy was drunk. He was dirty. He was not headed to something good that was going to happen in his life. You know, it was like 4:30 in the afternoon. It wasn't even beer 30. And he was already, you know, five sheets to the wind. So, but he was berating me for not being happy. And I thought, you know, I tended to get in that situation. I could give you a litany of things why I was preoccupied. There were a lot of things going on. And throughout my life, I've had to stop and tell myself in my journals, a very common thing in my journals, and I recommend everybody keep journals. Don't make them bitch fest where you go in and you're like, dear diary, you know, Susie pissed me off again. Don't do that. Try to get some insight. But something I have told myself over and over and over again is stop complaining. You're going to look back on this and you're going to realize you were really having fun or you were ignoring what should have been fun. And you're, you know, and I would walk around insisting I'm not having fun when in fact, you know, I was having fun. This was true. I was living out of my car and sleeping on friends' couches. No job, no place to live, no girlfriend, no hope for the future. And I remember writing that, you know, John, don't you dare look back on this and thinking you're having a good time. You're not. You're miserable. And I look back now and I was having a blast.
Right.
So that kind of insight, looking at that kind of stuff, you know, the caveat to that is that what was driving my apparent unhappiness was that sense of desperation, that sense that I had to solve things now. I had problems, and the problems were hard for me to define because I had no job, no girlfriend, no place to live. I didn't know what city I was going to wind up in, and all these things were pressing on me. When really those were still first world problems. I had a bank account. I, you know, when I left my job, they gave me some, you know, some departation cash, and I wasn't destitute. I was unmoored at the time, and I didn't know how to define it. I didn't know how to just sit back and say, oh, okay, I'm going to land on 2 feet. I'm going to be okay.
Yeah.
You know.
Right.
You know, I didn't have a family in the back car with me. You know, in the back of the car with me.
Right.
You know, may have complicated things, but I was looking at the bad side. So this may not be answering your your question, but you know, finding out where people are at is a relatively simple process. If they're coming to you, if it's a pull type of thing, you know, there are pull and push marketing things. Pushing would be like AdWords, you know, hey, do you have headaches you want to get rid of? Go over to this site and we'll talk about that. So you're pushing people over there. If you're pulling people along, you're going to your you're going to your list and you're trying to pull the people out of your list who are maybe there passively. Yeah, I'll get your damn newsletter, you know, and they're on your email list. And then you're trying to pull them into your world. So there's different ways that you position it, whether you go at it directly or indirectly. In other words, one of my favorite tactics or theories about tactics of advertising is coming in through the side door. And Halbert and I used to talk about that all the time because he had spent a lot of time in New York, and we'd laugh about how New Yorkers would come to our events, and New Yorkers think they're the savviest people on the planet. They walk around and they, you can't BS me. You know, you're not going to trick me. I know your game, bozo. And we used to laugh because those were the easiest guys to persuade. We just take one step over and come in the side door and say, right. Yeah, you know, something as simple as the simplest takeaways. Yeah, you know, I got this cool thing, but you wouldn't want it. You're way too hip for this kind of stuff. You know, I'm sure you got more money you know what to do with. Wait a minute. What do you mean? You know, we got them. The more sophisticated people are the guys who are not sophisticated. There are some people who – those people like hostile everything. Their first response is hostility. You can't sell me. I don't care what you have. I'm not going to get it. So you have to be very direct. You have to bring them in through that hook in the headline. Other people are more – I'm not sure what the right word is. Certainly not naive and not gullible, but they're not close-minded to a lot of things. So the hook may be almost overkill. So you have to kind of dance around and understand what it is. They may not even understand what the problem is. They may be even less well-defined. It's like they may not even realize that the lottery may solve a few of their problems. For them, you've got the problem of they've never bought anything through direct response before. They've never responded to an ad, or they're just not in that mindset. So you have to come up to them and not only let them come up with this idea on their own, which is, you know, where NLP and a lot of the tactics that writers use come in for persuasion. But you have to do it in a way that makes them feel like – I almost hate to say, I'm real hesitating to say this, but I might as well say it. Like you, their new best buddy, you know, your BFFs. And there's nothing wrong with that in that, you can even say, look, I've never met you, but I believe I understand your problem. And that's why so many of us try to find those problems in ourselves. Why the best copywriters are really, if you take their body of work and lay it out end to end, it's kind of a confessional.
Yeah.
It's because we find where the problems are. I may not have had your exact problem because I've never been married, but I have been in relationships and I have had a heartache, and I understand what it's like to have somebody tell you they no longer want to be with you, blah, blah, blah. If I'm talking, you know, if I'm selling a relationship product or something, you find it. If you can't find it, then you don't go that route. You take a different tactic because you never want to lie. You'll be discovered by most people in your copy very, very quickly.
Yeah.
What the average writer doesn't understand is just how much experience you have if you've lived past the age of 18 that does relate to what everybody else has, because it comes down to that basic Maslow thing we were talking about last time, that what is it like to be a human, you know?
Right.
And you know, the worst thing I can see in rookie writers is they'll make a joke about something they shouldn't make a joke about. I've seen people writing to people about, you know, who've had heart attacks, and they make a joke about it. Hey, how's the old ticker, Bob? You know, and you can do that if you have that kind of relationship. But if you don't, you don't do that. You don't make fun of that stuff.
Right, right.
And you don't try to be clever when somebody is desperately looking for information.
Right.
So you have both tools in your kit, you know, the direct assault and the more subtle working your way in and letting them make the decision later. That was a long way around the block to make a relatively simple point, but it's a question that comes up from writers a lot.
Yeah, no, it's very relevant. And, you know, let's drill down to a specific. Let's take something like, because, you know, again, people think, again, there's just an art to being persuasive, that it's not manipulation, but you have to, you know, we talk about entering the conversation, but then you also have to engage the conversation. So let's take something, for instance, like law of attraction. Okay, people that are heavy into law of attraction, they truly believe that they can meditate and manifest things in their lives. And I happen to believe that that's possible. I can't say that I have practiced that act directly. I haven't sat and chanted or read something over and over. But I've seen enough evidence of law of attraction in my life to where it's just, I can't deny that it exists. Our relationship is a result of law of attraction.
I would actually argue with that. My experience was, and I went through all this stuff before the law of attraction even existed. This is back doing Og Mandino stuff. If people have read his book, The Greatest Salesman in the World. Stuff. Yeah. He actually, at the end of every book he wrote, he said, "Write out your desires, say them, mean it, feel what it's like, and get into it." And I did that. And I remember putting aside my list of wants and stuff, and also Think and Grow Rich. That was a big part of it. And I got everything that I wrote down once I started realizing what I wanted. Because when I first started writing down what I wanted, I wasn't clear on it. Do I want to live at the beach? I wasn't sure. Do I want a boat? Do I want a big house? Do I want a family? I wasn't sure. So learning to decide what you want is part of the process, and that can take you a couple of years. Mm-hmm. The key, though, for me, and the key for you too, when you did this, I'm pointing at you, it's pretty funny, is that yes, having these things, making these goals real is step one. So that you understand what it is. You can't just say, "I'm unhappy, universe, make me happy." And if your thing was, "I'm a happy-go-lucky guy," that ain't going to work. Mm. You got to get more specific. And once you are specific, then the next step becomes easy to take, which is, I want to meet Carlton. Carlton's going to be in Chicago. I'm going to be in Chicago. Let's go meet Carlton. So that then becomes action. That then becomes making a plan and then putting it in action. That was the big epiphany for me when I was 20 years old, was, and actually when I was 32, when I read Think Grow Rich and realized not only could I want something, because I thought that was verboten, and I didn't realize I could want something, and then make a plan for it and then put that plan into action. Just those simple three things just transform my life immediately. But I have noticed that the universe rewards positive action. So once you get going, sometimes I can't deny that things have happened that were serendipitous. That, I turn a corner and there's the person I was looking for, where I had no idea how to find them, just stumbling on things. But for me, that's more of that thing of opportunity is whispering in the wind, and it's always there. When I was in LA as a rookie, Halbert and Jay Abraham were down there too. That didn't last very long. Jay is still there, and actually he was just a couple of miles from my house, but I didn't even know who he was. I'd never met Halbert, and Halbert left just a couple of years after we got together, and he wound up in Florida. And and what led me to them was just such tenuous, small little things, snatches of overheard conversations in a room. Somebody said, "Yeah, I answered this ad in the LA Times, and this guy's a nutcase, and he said something about Claude Hopkins." I read Claude Hopkins. "Who is this guy? Blah, blah, blah." I found him, met Jay. Didn't like Jay, but my goal was larger than me liking him or not liking him. So I kept at it, met Gary through Jay, blah, blah, blah. Things go on. So the universe, in my opinion, rewards it. I don't know what that mysterious process is, but I know it ain't just sitting around wishing for it to happen. So that's my beef with these things. You're leading people down a thing where you think you can think or wish or do magical thinking and have this stuff happen. You've got to get your ass out of the house, and you've got to you got to put shoes on, and you got to expend a lot of sweat and blood. Yeah. And you got to prepare. If you had met me and you weren't prepared, that wouldn't have made any difference.
Right.
I meet people all the time. You were prepped. So you got to put all of that in there. In fact, if you dissect that whole thing, and folks, if nobody knows the story, we've talked about this a lot. I had a hot seat event in Chicago. Didn't know Kevin from anybody, and he had this grand plan to meet me. And I'm not sure you thought past that, but you, somehow you weaseled your way in. I asked you to sit in on part of the hot seat, right?
Yeah.
I don't even remember
how. I'd proven myself a little bit to you in the insiders group by doing critiques and that sort of thing. So you had enough confidence to know I wasn't a crackpot, or at least had some abilities. But beyond that, it wasn't much.
I didn't learn you were a crackpot until much later.
I'm good at hiding that.
So what you did was a professional form of stalking.
Yeah.
Which worked. It's what I did with Halbert, essentially. I made myself available to Halbert, didn't push, and kind of showed up at where he was going to be, never pushed, and just made myself more and more valuable.
Right. So let's say there's a great lesson in that, of course, which, you know, yes, you can manifest things, but be ready, be prepped, and be prepared to add value, because that's the only reason it's going to ever move to the next level. But let's take it back to, again, the basic, the wide net prospect who's into Law of Attraction because they love the idea of it. They saw The Secret. They were very overwhelmed. It makes perfect sense. They've got their vision board. They're chanting their desires, and maybe nothing's happening for them. And then so when you write to them, you write a line like, at a certain point, you'll say something like, If you've been focused on finding just the right person to help you take it to the next level, then it's probably no mistake that you're reading this today.
That's good.
So, and it's a little bit manipulative because you know they believe that. But again, I guess it comes down to, if you believe in your product and you're offering something good, there's certainly no harm in that, right?
Well, not only no harm, but there's shame on you if you don't use everything you can to bring... You know, remember that all, in my experience, all sales transactions are inherently hostile events in the human-to-human interaction. Most people don't want to be sold. Very rarely, when you go to the store for milk and you're at the store for milk, you're there, you just want the damn milk, you grab the milk and you leave. That's not a hostile interaction. But
right.
If that guy leaves the store with more than the milk he went to the store with, he encountered some kind of sales process, you know, whether it happened in his mind, whether he saw a commercial 5 days ago or he read something or somebody said something about a word of mouth,
right,
stuck in his head, ignited, oh, there's those special crackers that, you know, whatever, blah, blah. And since I'm here, why don't I go down the health food aisle and see
boner,
blah, blah, blah.
Crackers.
The what?
Boner crackers.
yeah, the blue crackers. Go to the hospital if you have a cracker. That's the morning. So you know, but most people don't want to be sold. Especially, I think it's more evident in the higher price stuff. People coming to seminars. Some of the biggest compliments and testimonials I've ever had have been from people who said, damn you, Carlton, I woke up at 3 a.m. I couldn't get back to sleep until I picked up the phone and called up and ordered that damn thing you told me about in the afternoon, in the ad I read in the paper in the afternoon, or in the email that you sent me. That to me is where I'm putting stuff in. It's cooking and it happens.
Right.
You like to have it happen fast,
right?
But online, we tend to think that things happen often faster than they really should. It takes time sometimes.
And it takes,
you know, the average person used to need to see a commercial, I forget what it was, somewhere between 7 and 13 times before they would actually click on before it would stick in their head. As far as print ads and direct mail, especially, we knew a lot of people needed to see a piece of direct mail 3 to 12 times. So that's why if a piece worked, we would remail it, because we'd pick up the low-hanging fruit first, then we'd mail it again, and we'd get 50% of what we did the first time. This was almost like clockwork. And we mail again, we get 50% again. And we say, why didn't these people buy the first time? They opened it. It's because they needed to cogitate more. So we pick up the easy ones, then we pick up the ones that needed to think about a little more, then we pick up the ones that maybe needed a bigger kick in the ass, because on that third mailing, we would say, you know, last chance offer, or, you know, we'd start to up the ante a little bit. And that was knocking more and more of these people off the fence.
Right.
In direct mail, it's great because it costs money to mail. You're not, you know, you're not patient, but you know that the odds are on your side from experience. If it worked in the first mailing, it'll probably work in the second mailing, until you get to a point that you're still bringing in sales, but it costs more to send the thing out than it does to bring the money back. So there's that point of diminished return. So you stop mailing, you either change the letter, or you move to the next project or something. So once you understand that, that's why guys from direct response, old-time veterans, old school guys, understand the markets a lot better, because even among those that 5 to 10% of the people of a list who are going to buy, within that, there's a whole other world of a population of people who will buy right away, of people who need to be convinced, of people who are openly hostile to you even contacting them, people who need to get all kinds of things going on. And so you start to play this psychological game. And that's why the later in a series of direct mail ads, which we can all learn a lot about, the more, you know, you make your basic case and you get that down, that's the pitch. Then you start adding immediateizers, order now or we'll give your spot away, last chance offer. This is your third and final alert on this. We will never mail you again. In fact, we'll take you off the list if you haven't, blah, blah, blah. You start upping the ante just to move these people off. And it's not to trick people. Well, it is kind of to trick people. That's a naughty word. But it's to help people with their own inherent stubbornness. They want this. And you always have a great guarantee anyway. So if they decide that I didn't want it after all, they have buyer's remorse, send it back. You get 100. I don't think I've ever, except for a few seminars maybe where you can't do a 100% refund. With products, I always do it. It's 100% refund. You don't want it. You give them a period of time. Maybe it's 3 months. Maybe it's a year. Maybe it's forever. But, you give them an opportunity to send it back for a full refund. That's if you don't have a product you can stand behind like that, you got no business trying to sell it in the first place.
That's right.
But people need stuff. People are out there. They're desperate for solutions to their lives. And maybe you can't make them happy. Maybe you can't make them rich right now. But maybe you can knock one of those items off their list. Maybe you can help them with the nails to finish the birdhouse out back. Maybe you can help them understand one tiny thing about business. That'll be kind of an epiphany that will help them, so they won't get taken by the Yellow Pages guy the next time he calls, and they spend their entire marketing budget on a Yellow Page ad. You're providing value, you're helping to educate, you're helping bring them into the thing. And one of the best things you can do, over and over again I say this, as a marketer, you can be a conduit. You can be the window to a different world, because you're savvy, you understand what's going on, and you're offering to help them at some level. Buy my book, talk to me as a life coach, buy my product, join my list, get involved with this, do whatever. But I'm on the inside, you're on the outside. Let me help you get on the inside. Even if you don't come completely on the inside, let me smear a part of the window so you'll be able to see what's going on, so you'll have a better idea, so you'll be better informed, better prepared, better whatever next time, that you'll actually move ahead. And if you become that guy, that's a foot in the door. And as the old school salesman often talked about, that foot in the door, that's all they needed. It's just enough. If the door's slamming in your face and you're talking to wood, you can't make a sale. Foot in the door, you can at least continue that conversation and you can keep going. So it doesn't work all the time. The old time salesmen, they all limped. And they knew that, but they also knew when to call it off,
Right,
so they would push. But at a certain point, they're not going to make the sale, and you got to keep moving on. You're not going to sell 100%. And in direct response, we know that we often sell 5% or less of a certain list. So not just the majority, but the vast majority of people are going to turn you down in this offer. That's why you need large lists, so that small slice represents a decent result. I'm not sure where we're going. We're talking about people's psychology. I think basically we can sum this up with people are leading lives of quiet desperation. And if you have something that can alleviate even a part of that, come on like a hero. When you're marketing, you're coming on, don't be shy about this. What you have is not boring to the guy who has a problem that you're about to solve. Maybe boring to you, but if it's boring to you, you're thinking wrong. Yeah. You're not a good marketer. You're not using empathy. You've lost sight of the zeitgeist of the list that you're going after. So just reconnect.
Or you've been teaching it too long and it has become boring to you. But that's something going back to stand-up that we had to remind ourselves all the time. It's like, oh, crap. You know, if I have to hear this joke one more time. Well, they've never heard it. It's going to blow their minds. But if you sell it short and you go, they go, okay, well, that didn't appear to be worth the energy he just expelled. So it must not have been funny. So it's just about, a lot of times it's just you need to add one new element to it that can make it all fresh.
I just saw an interview. What's his name? This old school stand up is interviewing people, and he was interviewing Lily Tomlin and Steve Martin separately. Mm-hmm. Did you see this? I think it's on HBO or Showtime or something. And the Lily Tomlin one was pretty interesting. They were talking about Richard Pryor, and she was good friends with him and things like that. But the Steve Martin one actually touched on exactly what you were saying. Steve said, I reached a point where I knew the act was working. This was when he was a wild and crazy guy. He'd come out with the arrow through his head, and he played the banjo in the white suit. And he would open for rock acts to stadiums.
Right.
But he said, you know, he knew there was a point where where it wasn't going to be new anymore. But during that period where he really nailed it, he knew that he could do what he was doing, and it was new to this audience. It may not be new to him, but it was new to that audience. So he would just sell it. He would do it, but he'd do the same thing. Then he said it transformed, and he knew he had to get out of that when it became a comfortable party and people were shouting along with him, you know, well, excuse me, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right.
And the audience was shouting back, and he knew that was, okay, this ain't going to last very long. So I peaked. And then he knew he was going to move along, and then he started getting involved with Saturday Night Live and worked into movies and things like that. So he saw a hit. So just like you said, he changed it a bit. Still a comedian, still using what he had, but he wasn't relying on that stand-up thing. Rather than go back and try to create a new stand-up thing based on that,
right.
Like, you know, George Carlin would be the other side of that.
Right.
His shtick was to do that, but as you've said before, he'd work on it for months.
He would do the special, and then he would take 10% of what he did on the special as a foundation and build from it. And it could be torturous to be in those audiences early on because he's literally working out of a notebook.
Right.
And a lot of it's just undeveloped. But you'd catch those magic moments, and he was going to close with 10 minutes of puns, and you'd be fine. And Louis C.K. does the same thing now. He's made that pact with himself in his career to say, I'm going to be one of the greats, and I'm going to do the work. Seinfeld's the same way. Nobody could need money less than Jerry Seinfeld. But for some reason, he forces himself to sit down and write new material. He loves
legacy.
It.
Carlin finished one of his last, I saw his last HBO special, and he passed on not too long after that. He was working right up until the end.
Yeah. He looked like a little old man by then, but it, you know, he was only getting more pissed off.
Yeah, that's true.
I loved it. So, all right, we could go on. This is lots.
No, I think we can.
Lots
we can
of great
put
stuff.
Put a bow on this one.
Yeah. So just, I'm sorry, I kind of, you know, jumped on your closing thought there, but anything you wanted to get back to?
No, I think what's interesting about these things, Kevin, is when you and I started talking, you know, I actually had a thought that we'd stay focused on this one narrow part of this thing. We didn't. And it kept branching off. And that's actually one of the lessons of these things is that there is no single magical psychological insight that you're going to have that's going to solve everything. And one of the things that really opened up the world to me was being able to take things and break them down and deconstruct them into their elemental parts. So any business problem can be broken down into a couple of basic things. That's why I can do a hot seat with a guy I've never met before. I have no idea what business is in. And while he's telling me what his business is and what his problem is, I can pretty much solve this problem, or at least get a start on it, because there aren't that many business problems. It's either you need more customers, you need a better sales funnel, you need to not do this anymore. That's always a big answer. You know, there's only a few problems everything breaks down to, but everybody thinks their problem is unique. Mm. Their list is unique. Their buyer's unique. Their situation's unique. Everything's unique. And it's just not. So once you start breaking down life into these things, you it's much easier to look at things. And then when you build it back up into a grand theory, like, you know, these insights, you know, these dreams of glory, these, you know, leading lies of quiet desperation, it really gets down to some very basic, fundamental, human, very human things. And if the world wasn't as big as it was, and it was a village of a couple hundred people, and you knew everybody, you'd have much, it'd be much easier for you to get these insights. As it is, we live in a world of increasing isolation where much of our contact with other people is virtual or digital. Mm-hmm. And we don't have more friends, or we don't know more people than people did in medieval villages. There's there's some evidence that we know a lot less, that our worlds are shrinking very, very quickly. And that means these people have a lot less opportunity to see that other people have the same problem they have, or that this is not an uncommon problem. You know, now if, you know, back in a medieval village, if Joe the barber caught the plague, everybody knew about it and they started to act. Now, Joe the barber goes home and he sits down, he catches the plague and he thinks he's the only one with the plague, you know, and he's not. It's a plague. So, right. You know, so I don't know. That's probably another one we should look into. But anyway, the main lesson is people, you know, don't know how to define what it is that's bugging them. And as a writer, if you can define that for them, you've done them a great service right there to helping them do that too. That then opens the door to a further communication about, I have this that maybe will help even more. Maybe you ought to give it a try. It's completely guaranteed. Why don't you come into this? Great. That makes sense?
Awesome. Yep.
Boy, that one was all over the map. Yeah. That was
all right. Well, you know, that's the beauty of it, because every path we go down leads somewhere great. So you got to listen to all of it, because you don't know where the nuggets are going to be. We're not going to make this simple for you, folks. Give us an hour and you'll come away with 3 to 5 things that you can apply and a whole lot of cool words around them.
that's
our USP.
We're not gonna make this simple for you. That's funny. All right, Kevin.
All right, buddy. See you on the next one.
Okay, beautiful.
Bye.